Hello and welcome to the Freaking Awesome Podcast. It's Sunday, February 14th, 2021. I'm Benjamin Abaya, and joining me today, she is the author of the Book of Awesome Black Americans, and she is also the founder of Just Add Color at colorwebmag.com. She has written for Shadow and Act, Slash Film, and Mediaversity, and countless other sites. Please welcome back Monique Jones. Hello, Monique.
Hi.
Welcome back. How are you? It's been a while because I think the last time it was Lovecraft Country, right?
Right.
Yes. How did you... I didn't actually finish the season. How did you feel overall about the season?
Complicated.
Okay. I'll probably watch it sometime. Like, I think I stopped at episode 5. And then after that, I think I just... fell off of it just because at the time I stopped paying for HBO, so then I just renewed it like over this winter break. So yeah, I'll probably rejoin and tweet about my reaction to it too. And joining us, he is the creator of Million Dollar Underwear Zine and our official designated guest when it comes to Warner Brothers films premiering on HBO Max, I guess we could say. Please welcome comedy writer and returning guest Joel Barber.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Yes. Do you like that as being now the our Warner Brothers film designated guest when it comes to HBO Max?
Yeah. That's fine.
Okay. So for listeners, I think you know that he was in our guest for the Little Things, and then I think we decided that he'll just... we'll welcome him back every time a HBO Max movie comes out this next past year, because there'll be tons of HBO Max movies this past year. If you're new to the podcast, we usually discuss the things we watched, listened, played, and read throughout the week, and we end it with a main discussion. This week's main discussion is the film Judas and the Black Messiah. But first, there is a trailer talk. This week's trailer talk is Zack Snyder's Justice League.
He said the age of heroes would never come again.
It will. It has to.
We live in a society where honor is a distant memory. Isn't that right? Batman.
That is a clip of the trailer of Zack Snyder's Justice League, directed by Zack Snyder. I think we all know who stars in this film because it came out 3 years ago. And the history is that something unfortunate happened during the filmmaking of the original Justice League. And then Zack Snyder had to step away from the film. And then Joss Whedon had to come in to, you know, helm the film as a director. And they released the film in 2017. I couldn't believe that was like 3-4 years ago almost. And then afterwards, fans, I guess you could say, weren't feeling it. Some fans were, some weren't. And then they demanded supposedly a Snyder cut out there. I don't even know if even Zack Snyder even said there was his own cut out there. I don't know the details about that whole fiasco, I guess you could say, about fans wanting the Snyder cut. But then Zack Snyder, the past year, eventually said, he announced that he was going to release his cut. And I don't know if he shot some scenes or he just added scenes that he shot that in the... And then it looks like it's a different, that slightly different story from the Joss Whedon cut that came out 3 years ago. So now I just want to know, I'll start with you, Monique. Do you think the age of heroes will come again when it comes to this trailer?
I think my question is, do I care if the age of heroes comes again? Because yes. Maybe it's because I have to like write about it all the time for my job at Shadow and Act. I have to keep up with particularly Ray Fisher's ongoing saga with Warner Brothers. But I've just been I'm glad the trailer is out finally, but I'm just kind of like, I'm so tired of hearing about the Snyder Cut. It seems like it's been coming for years, and just been like a long drawn out process, and I just want it to be over. Like, I just want it to come out and just we can be done with it. I mean, I guess overall though, I mean, I'm interested to see what is changed. Granted, I haven't seen the first Justice League, mostly just because I just wasn't fully interested in it, I don't think. But I am interested to see like what the fans will say about the Snyder Cut and if it's going to live up to all their dreams and expectations, because it seems like a lot of fans seem to think that this will be the holy grail of superhero movies, and I just hope it like doesn't fail them.
I feel that, because I was also like wondering how this cut will be significantly different from the original one. And from the trailer, you see some scenes pieced together here and there. And it feels like you're right. Like, there's this huge expectation now. Then I'll feel really bad if fans feel like they're let down when it comes to this. How about you, Joel? There's in the trailer, I'm going to quote it, semi-quote it, but it says there's this particular character says that we live in a society where honor is a distant memory. So when it comes to this Justice League, is the 2017 a distant memory to you?
No, I'm just laughing because once again, I'm having to talk about Jared
Leto. Oh, yeah.
I'm... As a fan of like cinema, and okay, put this as a comic book fan, I'm excited to see this because Zack Snyder does kind of like, he's all about being authentic or true, and that's like kind of cool to me on like a 0.5 level. But as just like a moviegoer, I'm tired of that style that he's been doing for 3 or 4 films now. So I'm not excited about this. It's going to be on HBO Max. I'm going to watch it. I'm like Monique said, I'm overhearing about the Snyder Cut. To me, I'm just like, cool. All right. So once this is done, can we never speak about this again?
Yes. This also reminds me, I think, I don't know if we're all big fans of Dr. Dre, but I remember when 2001 came out, and then afterwards when it was successful, everyone wants his album, The Detox. And for years, there was rumors that he's going to release this album. And I think he never actually, I don't know if he did, because I haven't been up to the music. Okay, he never put it out. But for so many years, I remember fans of his, and even like hip hop fans were like excited for it. And then he never released it. So it reminds me of that whole, that, you know, in the discussion boards where you talk about there's this like thing that's going to come out. And once it's coming out, like, I wonder, it feels like it's just going to come and go. Like, it just feels like this is going to, you know, it's going to be released. People will talk about it. And by the end of this year, we're not even going to probably think about it as much anymore, because it's like a 4-hour movie. And I feel like there's not a lot of stuff you could add that, I think the original cut was like 3 hours, almost 3 hours long, or a little bit more. Yeah. So I don't know what they're going to add. I do wish they, at least when it comes to characters like Cyborg or The Flash, like at least have their stories told a little bit better in this cut. Because I know they were there in the original cut, but they weren't that as significant, I feel like, when it comes to their own personal stories. So we'll see.
And if I may add, just, I don't know if it's from a woman's perspective that I'm coming at this like this, but I just get sick of, in general, with fandom culture, and I guess specifically like the quote unquote fanboy culture, like everything has to be like, it's got to be 4 hours long, or it's, we got to have everything. like it doesn't have to be like, even with like Star Wars and stuff like that, is everyone's like, we need the full cut, we need blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we don't need it, though. It's a movie. We don't need it.
I said, yeah, exactly. Like sometimes they're best for what it was released like at that time. So yeah. we're gonna move on to what we've been doing this past week. I'm gonna start with you, Monique, because you have actually something interesting and something that's probably I feel like will bring a lot of listeners back when it comes to this particular thing. But what have you been doing this past week?
Well, I have been preparing and live tweeting. I prepared to watch the Disney Plus release of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, and I live tweeted it on Friday, and or I guess I should say Lunar New Year for whenever people are listening to this podcast in the future.
Yes.
so I watched that, live tweeted it. I had a lot of fun. The week beforehand, I was watching everything I could about stuff that I guess I'm, you know, being a hypocrite about fanboy culture, because I also was like looking at everything I could about this movie and what happened with the making of it. And I had already read the Shondaland oral history of the making of Cinderella when it came out. I think that article came out in like 2018 or something, and so I'd already read that then, but I was just looking at all these new videos of the behind the scenes footage and just excited to finally see this movie. I mean, I already own it on DVD.
Oh, nice.
So like me and my sister already have it, and we watch it you know, on our own time anyway, but it was just nice to have it finally on Disney Plus, because it's been so long and like there's been no reason why it shouldn't be on streaming. And so finally the powers that be have heard the fans and have put it on Disney Plus. And so basically just the whole week up until Friday, I was just, you know, immersed in Cinderella lore and fandom and all that stuff. And of course, I low-key, high-key bragged about how in 2018, I also got a Twitter shout-out from Paolo Montalban, who is the prince in the movie. And so I relived the moment that I, like, died in my chair when I saw that on Twitter. So just a lot of things have been going on, but all of them related to Cinderella.
Did they do like an HD version of the? I don't know how they convert. If it's just same.
I think they basically just took the version that they put on standard television and just put it on Disney Plus. I guess they didn't have like any other versions that they filmed, because I thought maybe they would like remaster it or they just have like, they even have the commercial breaks in there, so it's like so like they have the fade to black moments where it would go into whatever was happening in 1997, but thankfully, or maybe not thankfully, they don't have the commercials. It would have been cool to see what was going on back then, but it's just fade to black, come back to the movie, fade to black, come back to the movie. But even still, it's like, at least it's on Disney Plus. If that's the only cut that they have, then great.
I do like how Disney Plus is taking taking advantage of like their streaming service to release like these type of films, or like old classics, I guess you could say, especially if it's like made for TV movie. I wonder, like, I'm trying to think of like what other things they did in the past that they could release, because I remember this Cinderella, the 97 Cinderella version was just, it was always talked about, especially where in my junior high when I was, I think when it came out, like everyone loved it, and I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting, where culturally it's relevant, relevance is in there still until today too. But I'm looking forward to like actually watching it while reading. I actually didn't read your tweets because I didn't want to spoil myself of your thoughts right now. And then I was going to read it after I watch it, or read it while I'm watching it to see. I wish there was like a timer on tweets to see like where you're at in the movie when you're
right.
But yeah, looking forward to that. It's on Cinderella Disney Plus for any listeners. Do you have anything else to add besides that?
I mean, I guess I just wanted to say, I know everyone has like said this on Twitter before, but I guess just as a Black woman, like growing up with that kind of, like, in 1997, there was no Princess Tiana or anything like that. And so it was really inspiring and it was affirming to have a Black princess, to have Cinderella of all princesses, I think one of my favorite princesses, to be shown as a Black girl with braids, because as a lot of Black girls at that time, you grew up with braids or some kind of pigtails or something. And so it was just neat to see someone who is a, not just a royal, but just someone who is like battles insecurity and like, you know, negative self-talk and all kinds of stuff as she does in the movie, to see someone like that who looks like you be celebrated for who they are. And I think that's a lesson that stuck with me and is still something that I'm trying to apply to myself, even as a grown up, because I think a lot of us have, you know, times when we struggle with how society might view us or how we might view ourselves. And I think that's the lesson that I take away from this version of Cinderella, which is that you can be imperfect and still be seen as worthy to not just other people, but to yourself as well. And I like that they infused the Cinderella story with that kind of message. So I think it's something that all people who watch the movie can enjoy, but especially if you are a Black girl who wants to see more of yourself out there, I think it's a great movie to watch. And also, I mean, that also goes with seeing Whoopi Goldberg in the movie too. You know, someone with locks, like we don't even see that a lot in TV. And also to the Asian side of the equation, we don't see a lot of Filipino men in these roles. Yeah. We don't see a lot of Asian or South Asian men in these types of roles. Like I know Hollywood's trying to do that with their, you know, Crazy Rich Asian type thing with Crazy Rich Asians and Bling Empire and all that stuff, but we don't see a lot of that in general. And so it's just neat to see that the two leads of this movie are like two underrepresented people, and they are the stars, and you have to follow their love story and, like, you know, root for them. And so I think that that's really important.
It's interesting that you brought that up, because in 97, I don't know if because the internet wasn't as prominent as now, or like people don't really discuss it at the time, but having them as leads, like, I feel like back then, I wonder if people were up in arms but didn't have like a way to release that anger through like the internet and whatnot. Like you see people now when I forgot her name, but she's Ariel now for the new Halle Bailey. And when they announced her as Ariel, like a lot of people were up in arms about like, she's not a redhead, she's Black and everything. And I'm like I always refer to like the Cinderella 97, because I feel like there was like a time where I don't think this mattered to you guys, like why you guys are up in arms now. I don't know if it was because there was no internet at the time, but like in my time, like in my school, I don't think anyone was thinking that at the sense, like they were mad that Cinderella is played by Brandy. But at the time, like people were like, I think Moesha was still a thing back then, but like people were just excited, but that here's Brandy, you know, pop musician that's, you know, playing this role. And it was kind of cool to see her. And like Whitney Houston, I think Whitney Houston at the time was doing like big Hollywood roles, and she was doing this, you know, made for TV movie Cinderella version. You know, it was like kind of cool to see, and having that star power on screen, on their small screen, was kind of significant at the time. But yeah,
actually executive produced it too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's one thing that we have to I think that's one thing that we have to remember going forward, is that she produced a lot of movies that like really changed the game for how teenagers saw themselves, and I think that she doesn't get a lot of credit for that, but I think we should like look more at her producer credits too, to like remember that she was not only like the greatest singer of all time, but she was like she was beginning to be a really big force in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder what she would have done if she had, you know, been around today.
That's actually a good observation.
What else did she produce? Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
She produced Princess Diaries and Cheetah Girls.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some other things too. I know Shadow and Act has a short article about it, but she produced those two things for sure.
Yeah, Princess Diaries is a huge. I mean, I just watched it recently, and then that was a huge thing in the early 2000s. I remember a lot of people. That made what's her name? Now I forgot her name. And that's the way, like, a huge star after that. but yeah, thank you. You got anything to say, Joel?
I'd say my cousins liked Cheetah Girls growing up, so that was a big thing for me. And when I was at family things, I'm like, I don't get this because I'm about 4 or 5 years older than them, but I recognize how important it was to them.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same where I was. At the time, I think I was out of high school, and I didn't really. I know my niece loved it, but I didn't understand it at the time. But I could see how important it was. But yeah, thank you for sharing that with the Cinderella. I recommend listeners to like view your tweets and everything else you put out too. But especially when you were live tweeting to watch Cinderella on Disney Plus. Joelle, going to you. You also watched something old. I'm assuming a little bit more older. But what have you been doing this past week?
I have a Criterion Collection membership, and it's been kind of collecting dust. So this week, last week, I just went through and was like, let me see what you guys have. When I occasionally do watch, it's mostly for like Asian cinema from like late 90s, early 2000s. But this time I was just like, let me see what else is there. So I fell down like a Jane Fonda rabbit hole of Barefoot in a Park, Klute, and I watched something else with Cary Grant that I didn't really enjoy. But the last thing I watched was David Mamet's House of Games. That was his first film. I'm kind of a David Mamet stan, not the right word I want to use, but enthusiast. So finally getting a chance to see that, and it's peak David Mamet. It's a lot of fast-paced dialogue, sort of not more fast-paced. It's dialogue that sounds like you're being thrown into a world of con men and one-upsmanship, and it's got Ricky Jay in it. So I love that dude. Rest in peace to a legend. So it's definitely getting my full. I'm not getting rid of this channel, is what I'm saying.
I really recommend it. Like that put me on a lot of filmmakers I didn't realize. I like heard about these two filmmakers, but I didn't realize like how much films they've made or like directed and whatnot. I need to brush up on my like David Mamet stuff, because I think I've only watched, I want to say like two films from him. I don't even know that. I know one of them was Heist, which was like when I was in high school. I think that's the only ones. And I think I watched an older one. Is it Homicide? It stars, I'm trying to research. It is Homicide with William H. Mercy, and I think that's the only two films I've ever watched from him. But
I haven't seen Homicide, but have you seen Glengarry Glen Ross?
Yes.
I don't think he directed that one, but he wrote the play, and I took a theater class in college. We covered the play and the movie, and they're pretty much, there are differences, like there's like an extra act that like the movie doesn't do. And I think that's where I kind of fell in love with his films and his work. like I said, an enthusiast. So I there was a period, especially right after college, where that's if it wasn't David Mamet, I wasn't watching it. Not to say that every one of his films are good. He's got some. He's got some stinkers in there, but
who doesn't?
But it's a. I've never, even the bad ones, I'm like, okay, yeah, I kind of see where you're going with this. But I, his best film, I at least to me, is The Spanish Prisoner.
Is that on the Criterion?
No, I don't think it is. I caught it a long time ago on IFC. One day, I want to say like in college or during a summer between semesters, and it's got Steve Martin and a bunch of like the David Mamet like players that I call them, the ones he uses like the same actors over and over again. It was sort of like redone a few years later with Nicolas Cage and Matchstick Men.
That I was like
in the middle of the theater. And I'm with my roommate at the time, and I'm like, yo, this is A Spanish Prisoner. And it's just like three of us in a theater. And he's like, what? I'm like, this is David Mamet's Spanish Prisoner. And he was like, okay, all right, let's enjoy the rest of this film. But yeah, I highly recommend Criterion. It's if you like foreign films, which I do, they've got a like massive database of stuff, or the things I've been watching now are a lot of this like 50s, 60s, right as like color becomes like a big thing, like that's not quite 70s era yet of films, because being in film school for like a hot moment, everyone teaches you the 70s where films changed. Yeah. So I have no concept of, or a small concept of, what was film before everything changed? And that's what I'm just kind of been like looking at in this past, or plan to continue to look at for this next couple of weeks with the streaming service.
Yeah, I've been going through it, and I haven't watched anything recently. I do want to revisit some movies, because I feel like I've watched them once when I was like a little bit younger, but I want to revisit, because I think people were mentioning, oh, there was a movie that was out that people were comparing it to Paris, Texas. And I want to revisit that one, because I think I watched it when I was young, but I didn't understand what was it about at the time. So I need to rewatch it. But yeah, I recommend Criterion Collection, the Criterion Channel. I think it's like $6, right?
I bought when it first premiered, like that, when they announced that they were going to be like, hey, we're going to premiere in like a month or 2 months. Yeah. I went and just did like the year subscription. Mm-hmm. And then they gave you like a discount for early subscribers. So I have no concept of whatever the price is.
I think it's like $6 a month. And then did you, because you said you were early supporter. Did you get the card they gave? I don't know if you got one.
I don't know if I got the card.
Yeah.
They gave me a $10 like gift card and said, you can hold on to this as long as you like, and you can spend it in our store. So what I do is about the same time that they do like at Barnes & Noble, where you like everything is like half off.
Yeah, 50% off. Yeah.
They do their version of that. And I was just like, okay, so I bought Paris is Burning.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah.
60% off. So like, and I think they do that like once a year. They'll just give you like a $10 gift card, and I just hold out and wait until see what they have. So, I know they're gonna have like a Juan Carl Y,
yes,
like five or four, four film like collection, and I'm looking at that like, so that's gonna be how much off with the card? Like I'm just circling it, waiting for it to go, for that price to go down.
So what's unfortunate on my side is I own most of his films on the Criterion Collection, and I'm like, I had to double dip if I want to buy that box set. But it looks like a really nice box set, and it's Juan Car Y too. So, but yeah, thank you for sharing that for Criterion Collection. Speaking of Criterion Collection, hopefully this film will be in the Criterion Collection is Minari. Have you guys heard of this film?
Yeah, I've watched it for Common Sense Media.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And my review is out there for anyone who goes to Common Sense Media. You can read my review. But I really loved it.
Yeah, I'm on the same boat. Like, I want to read your review too. I think it's directed and written by Lee Isaac Chung, for those who don't know. But I really love Steven Yeun's like performance. I think I haven't seen him in this. I didn't watch Burning. I know there was like a film a couple years ago he's in. I've only known him when it comes to like The Walking Dead. What's that one movie on Netflix about a pig? Not a pig, but it's like a hippo pig. It's from
Okja.
Yeah, and Sorry to Bother You. So I've only seen him in some film roles, and then this is like the first time I've seen him in a more dramatic role, and I really loved it overall. I want to give a shout out to like Lee Lai to Mediaversity and A24, because they were giving like if you're a Patreon on Mediaversity, that they were giving like premiere passes or the screening from last week, and that's how I got the opportunity to watch it. There was like a Q&A afterwards from Zoom, of course, with the directors and actors. So it was kind of cool to see all of them talk about this. And as for the film itself, I love it. It's lovely. It's like endearing, very emotional, especially if you're an immigrant, especially like if you're an Asian American immigrant who came to America to find like more opportunities. And this takes place in like the 80s. So I came to America that same time, and I could see glimpses of like my dad like struggling to try to make him, you know, be at least like the breadwinner in the family, but also like trying to find something to do to like support his family. Like the son played by Alan Kim, who's very like adorable in the movie. There's so much things about him that I reminded of me how I sort of, when I was young, I kind of like didn't understand my culture as a Filipino, and then I kind of dismiss it, and then wanted to be more quote unquote like Western American. And like, you know, you get those moments in life where you want to assimilate yourself to American ways. And I kind of felt that until like, you know, later on you grow like more appreciation in your culture. But yeah, I really love it. Like, I think for those who don't know, it's about Steven Yeun's like character moving to like the roles of Arkansas, I think, and then trying to find like success as a farmer, which is seems impossible. But I love everything about it: the cinematography, the music. Oh, it escapes me now. It's the same composer that did The Last Black Man in San Francisco, so I'm like in love with the music for this film, and it just came out like this past week too. But Joel, did you know anything about it?
I'm unfamiliar with any of this, so okay. I'm like low key just on my phone trying to look up everything you guys are saying.
I think it's out on VOD in selected theaters too. I don't recommend going to theaters right now, but I'm pretty sure it's going to probably be on you know, one of the other streaming services like in a couple of months. Like I think A24 usually has like a deal with like Amazon sometimes, where if you have Amazon Prime, most of their films are on there. After they do their 3-year theater run and whatnot. But yeah, I recommend it. It is something I know. I don't really follow like award seasons, but I feel like he should at least be nominated for something in the coming years. And his wife, who's played by Han Yeri, that she did a tremendous job too. And grandmother, like there's like scenes I'm just thinking like that just made me tear it up, like just thinking about it. But yeah, I really recommend it. It's Minari, that's out right now in theaters.
I just wanted to say that one thing that I did like from the movie, and I guess also kind of depressed me at the same time, is that, Steven Yeun's character, like his struggle to, you know, make something of himself, it reminded me a little bit of my personal struggle to like try to make my website as big as it can be and to like make a name for myself. And I feel like a lot of people who are trying to be entrepreneurs in that way probably can like sympathize with his character just being like, I gotta make this work, this is gonna happen, and like someone else in your life being like, will you stop doing this, this is not, it's taking so long, why are you putting me on this journey? And like I feel sympathy with that, because it does take a lot of emotional and mental strength and like mental exercise to try to like tell someone of your vision and to like convince them of your vision. And it's often heartbreaking when it feels like you have to prove the vision for them to see it. So I thought, just from my own perspective, my outside perspective, like that's something that I really liked from this movie, among the other many storylines and ideas that are in it.
Yeah, besides like having it as being like you know, Steve Ewan's character as being Asian and whatnot, but like I feel like after anyone that watches this film, I think anyone could resonate that, yeah, like you said, like the struggle he had to go through to be somebody and whatnot, and having people doubting you and whatnot, and I feel like anyone could just resonate with that, especially. It's so heartbreaking in some of these scenes, like where you see what he wants to do and what his vision is, and it just feels very like, and then when certain things happen, you're like, oh man, like I feel bad, but you could tell like he wants it, like he's not going to give up on it and whatnot, and that makes, you know, that I think we all could see that in ourselves and in him and whatnot. But yeah, that's moving on from that. We're going to go straight to our main discussion. This week's main discussion is Judas and the Black Messiah.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror.
I will learn all that I can.
These ain't no terrorists.
You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder a liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder a revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
That is a clip from the trailer of Judas and the Black Messiah, which you could watch in theaters, which I don't think any of us would recommend at the moment, but also it's on HBO Max, where you have a subscription to HBO Max, directed by Shaka King, starring Daniel Kaluuya, Lakeith Stanfield, Dominique Fishback, Jesse Plemons, and Martin Sheen. This is the premise from IMDb, the story of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, and his fateful betrayal of the FBI informant William O'Neill. I'm going to start with you, Monique, because I read your review of the film, and I really liked it. And I want you to expand. I want our listeners also like go out there and read it too. Where you could find it and expand your review here.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I'm glad you liked it, because I don't know if it's taboo for a critic to reveal this, but sometimes, especially in this socially political climate that we're in, I get actually scared to like say something that's against the norm of what someone thinks I should say about, especially if it's about like a movie about civil rights or about race or something like that, because like it's a long story. I won't even get into that, but it's nerve-wracking, because people want you to say a certain thing about it, but in general, my own perspective of the movie is that I think it is a good movie. I think part of why in my review I say that it's a good movie for people who like know next to nothing about the Black Panthers, and this movie can be that kind of Black Panther 101 class for an audience that might not know anything about the Black Panthers. I think one thing that I felt kind of shut out of the movie about is because I think I might be just someone who's like too close to the source material in general to gain something new from it. And that's not a thing against the movie per se. It's that when I was growing up, like I basically, like my entire childhood was basically Black history class all the time. And like even living in Birmingham where it is Black history all the time, civil rights all the time, even if no one's talking about it, you go downtown and the 16th Street Baptist Church is still there. People are still holding church and the streets in downtown where people got hosed at are still there. People are still using them and all this stuff. Even some of the buildings, some of the literal decor of the buildings haven't changed, some of them. And so it's just like, all of it's still there. And so I'm like always surrounded by Black history and civil rights history and almost everything we watched was like, if it wasn't something regular like cartoons or like Saved by the Bell or whatever, it was something like my mom making us watch Roots every year during Black History Month, or watching Eyes on the Prize at school and watching the whole thing, including seeing Emmett Till's body in the movie. And it's just like having that like put in your mind as a second grader of like, oh my gosh, this is what they did to this child who's my age basically. And so like all of that, like reading Addie books and American Girl Addie books and going on the, what's the name? I can't believe I forgot the name of this encyclopedia brand because I put it in my book, but Africana, Encyclopedia Africana, and like reading about Black history facts and that, and everything was just Black history, it seemed like all the time, including down to our dolls, like only ethnic dolls. So it's like, I cannot escape any of it. And I mean, that's great because it was a foundation for me to, you know, be grounded in my Blackness and in my culture and all that stuff. But it's also just like, I think I'm at a point in my life where I've like learned all this 101 stuff when I was like between 5 to 10 years old. And so I'm just like, what else is there in this movie for me? And like, I personally would have liked to have seen more about William O'Neill's struggle. And I know the basis of the movie is about his struggle to like figure out what he's doing and why is he helping the CIA or FBI, and you know, how does he feel about the Black Panthers and their movement. But I feel like the movie was kind of like, it wanted to be a movie about William O'Neill, but it also seemed like it wanted to be more of a movie about Fred Hampton, which makes sense because he is, you know, a figure that should have his own movie. And I feel like the script or however it was directed, maybe there's like a push and pull that wasn't ever resolved with who the movie really wanted to be about. And I know it's supposed to be about both of them, but it seemed like the movie was trying to be two different movies at the same time to me sometimes. Like there were several scenes, for instance, that just seemed like Lakeith Stanfield, who I think is great in the movie, was just like in a completely different movie than Daniel Kaluuya. Like I think one scene that really shows this is when the Black Panthers are at the, I forgot the name of the group, but the rival group, I guess, the rival Black Liberation group. And they're trying to come to terms and like have some kind of unification of the groups. And so you have Dan Kaluuya and the other people playing the Black Panthers there. You have the other group there. And you can see that Daniel Kaluuya is in one movie, which is all about Fred Hampton, and I'm gonna, you know, bring these people together and all this stuff. And then you have Lakeith Stanfield, who's in a completely different mindset, and he's doing all these interesting like facial expressions, and like he's basically acting on like several levels at the same time, it seems like. And it just seems like, I want to know what all is going on with him that he can take my attention without saying anything from Daniel Kaluuya, who's having all the lines and saying everything. And so that's one scene. And another scene is really when you go into the mind of William O'Neill and you see him having this nightmare about him basically persecuting himself. And I wish we had gotten more of that kind of that kind of psychological struggle, and to like really see him dive into the depths of his like losing grip on reality, I guess. But we don't get as much as I would like. And I guess that's just because the nature of the movie is to educate audiences on what the Black Panthers really stood for. And so I guess in that sense, if you're just looking at it from that sense as an educational tool, then fine, the movie does succeed on that level. I think it just depends on what the audience is looking for and who this audience is speaking to. It seems like they're speaking more towards people that don't know a lot about the Black Panthers, rather than the audiences who want to get into like some of the finer details of things that are going on at the time. So I think hopefully I've explained myself well to, you know, let people know that this is a fine movie. It just not might be to everyone's tastes. That's my feelings.
I understand. Like I think you're telling it really well. I feel like the listeners will get more like the nuances about your what you think about it through your review of the movie. But I like what you just said, like there's some stuff I also felt like that too, but I want to know what like Joelle's thoughts about it first.
All right, I'm gonna have to look up Monique's review. A lot of what she said, I have like a note card, and she's like, "I'm just crossing stuff off." Like, I guess. Well, this is good, so it's not just like me feeling this way. I want to start. Daniel Kaluuya. I'm gonna ruin his name. I first time I saw him was like in an episode of Black Mirror, and he just keeps getting better, and I think this might be his best performance to date. And I don't know if this is going to be considered a film for this Oscar season or next season. Hopefully he gets nominated, but I wouldn't be shocked if it's that, oh, he's a contender, and then when nominations comes out he just like disappears. So I just want to go ahead and, as I say, give him his flowers now. I think his performance is awesome and great, and also probably what hurts this film, because coming into it, I, at least from like the name and the trailer, I'm thinking it's more about like O'Neill, Lakeith Stanfield's character's film, that he's going to be the lead, and Daniel's performance is so good that there are many times when, especially sort of like the scenes between O'Neill and his FBI handler, was it Jesse Plemons, that I'm like, can we just go back to like Fred Hampton? That like the performance is so strong that I'm missing Hampton as a character. And I'm like, I don't think that's what the film is. And I think like that scene where Monique brought up, where they're meeting with, I believe the group is the Crowns, and they're reading in the Crown, like the leader of that gang or group is reading the letter that the FBI, or the pamphlet that the FBI guys had come up with, and you're seeing the different expressions on Stanfield's face. And I'm like, yeah, this like it almost feels like we have to drag the like the scenes that the lines, the dialogue that Daniel's doing, God, I really wish I knew how to pronounce his name.
I don't know if I'm saying it correctly sometimes.
we'll go with that. Yeah. That like Kalua's performance is so strong that I'm like, yeah, like going back to Stanfield, cutting back to him, or when that guy's like, I know you, you're the guy who's like the fake FBI agent. I was like, oh, we have to go back to that plot. And I think because like Kalua's performance is so strong that you're like, oh, you want to see that movie. You want to see the Fred Hampton biopic because it's just so strong. And then just looking at it from a narrative point, like one of the things that I could say, like I'm going to go ahead, if I have to do a number system, I'd give this like a 3 out of 5.
Gave it a 3 out of 5.
Yeah. 3 out of 5, maybe 3.5 or whatever. That O'Neill's character isn't developed, that there should be like that scene where him and like little Rail near the end or at the bar, and he's telling him like, I don't want to do this, I don't know, like the paranoia that he feels, and then little Rail just gives him the badge from the beginning. I'm like, this is what this should have been more of if it's gonna be Judas and like that whole playing off the title of Jesus and Judas and the betrayal of, and this is Fred Hampton could have done so much more, that he was conflicted, and we don't really get that because once again Kalua's performance is so strong that you could kind of, I could picture somebody in the editing booth go, really, we don't need this, but it's so good, we're gonna keep it in. And that is kind of detrimental, but at the same time I really enjoyed it, that I'm glad they kept it in. The ending feels kind of like a punch has been pulled, and growing up I knew the Fred Hampton story, but when people would try to explain to me what the ending was, I was very confused, and I was hoping that this movie would expound on like a Wikipedia or what I had been told growing up, and I was like, nah, this still don't explain, like this feels like a punch pulled. And the title cards came up at the end, well, the title cards, the little postscript at the end about O'Neill. And I was just like, okay, not to say I need to see that actual scene happen, but I almost feel like this movie could have gone on a little bit longer about his experience in the like the Black Panthers. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm happy with what I have. I will gladly, so far of the new movies I've seen that have come out this year, this is probably on my top. It's there, but nothing else is there. Because Kalua's performance is so strong, and I'm going to go ahead and highlight. Everybody else gave great performances. His performance is just like 88 Michael Jordan chain, tongue out, dunking on everybody, and everybody else is the rest of the Bulls. Like, the Chicago Bulls were great players, but they don't shine as much as Michael Jordan. I feel like I got to say that's what's going to stay with me, and the story could kind of like fade away.
That's actually a good, it's almost as detailed as like how Monique's review is and her site is. I'm going to come off as someone who knows as much as like only an average person would know about the Black Panther Party. Like, I know who Huey Newton is. I know who, Bobby Seale. Just trying to think of his other name. And then I think I knew very little of Fred Hampton because he's from Chicago, and this is like the chapters from Chicago. So just because I'm from California, so I know a lot about, like, you know, Oakland's Black Panther Party, and you know, it started there. And when I heard about Fred Hampton, I probably was like in high school, and I only know as much as him being assassinated. I didn't know a lot about, I know also the Rainbow Coalition. I know those two things. Those are the only two things I knew about. Other than that, I did not know he was like betrayed at the time. And then especially when the trailer came out, like, I, you know, researched more about it and whatnot, and I didn't know it was like from an informant, and like how he, and the one thing I think that was jarring for me, and I think because I just know Latif and like Kalua from like other things, And then knowing the real history about what happened, that it like Latifah is supposed to be like a 17-year-old, and then O'Neill is supposed to be a 17-year-old when he was basically not recruited, but when he was, you know, approached by the FBI. And then I just get that sense, like, you know, he's supposed to be that young in this film. Like, in my mind, I'm like, wow, that was really daring if he was 17-year-old pretending to be an FBI agent and trying to convince these people in the pool hall that he's going to take their car. I was like, that's kind of brave of him to just do that back then. Like, I don't think any 17-year-old would try to do that now. And then just knowing that Fred Hampton died in 21, at the age of 21, Kahlua looks like he's a little bit older. I mean, I think he's like in his 30s right now. Like, that kind of ticks me out, like, knowing the history, like, knowing the real story of Fred Hampton, like, imagining, like, what if they were younger, like, younger actors playing those roles. I think it will have a more impact for me, knowing that they were so young, but, like, he was running, you know, the Black Panther Party in Chicago that young. Other than that, I'm trying to think of all my notes right now. I think I'm on, like, the same boat as you, Joel, with Daniel's performance. Like, it was really great. But at the same time, I'm also in the same boat with Monique in her review, where she talks about, like, it's almost baseline, like, almost, like, impersonating. Like, I just, because it's so magnetic and so, like, he takes, like, when he's in the scene, he takes, like, the whole scene. Like, you just listen to him because of his performance and whatnot. There, and then it gives other actors in the scene, like Dominique Fishback's character, the girlfriend of Fred Hampton, where she's so soft-spoken in the scene, but I feel like we need more of her. Like, I think in your review, Monique, you talked about, like, how she's, like, kind of wasted in the film, but I feel like that her as a person felt like at least in the film, they try to put some humanity into Fred Hampton as, like, I know he's, like, a revolutionary, and, like, I feel like they try to ground him in certain scenes, which I liked, but I wish there was more of, where you just see those two talking about their, like, relationship. I think when they first meet, like, Fred Hampton was, like, really shy, and I felt like that could, like, anyone could resonate with that, like, meeting someone that you think you're interested in, and then just seeing that blossom as, like, you know, as a relationship. I feel like there should be more of that sometimes in the film. Overall, I think that we're like, this just should have been like a mini series somewhere, because I think there's so much rich, like, stories told in this within the Chicago, like, Black Panther Party, that I feel like you could have made, like, small little episodes here and there about each character, and see, because, like, they have characters in here where it's, like, you know, part of the Black Panthers part, but you just see them, like, you see them there, and then they die, and then I feel like they die so quickly that I felt bad, but at the same time, like, I want to feel like, you know, why did they die? Like, it's hard to, like, you only relate those deaths to, like, I'm going to get political, but, like, through the lens of now, like, how Black Lives Matter movement, like, you see those because you see it on, like, you know, your mobile devices, so you relate those two images, but I wanted them to tell their story back then, like, how that was related through their eyes, through, you know, when through the Black Panther Party. I don't know if I'm making any sense right now. Like, using, they're paralleling those instances in the movie, but I feel like like, if you know about, like, the Black Lives Movement, like, you could see those, you know, parallels, but I wish they could make their own version where we could feel bad, or, like, not feel bad, but, like, we know their story more than just them just being characters. Because I know, like, one of the characters was, like, created, I forget which one was it. I was, like, reading up on this, like, he was just created for the movie. Then when they died, it's like, oh, I think, like, I was, like, really, I felt bad. And then when I researched, it's like, oh, they were just created for this movie because they just needed someone to die in the movie. It's kind of weird. But yeah, other than that, like, I think I want to see Shaka King's, like, Well, like he is a filmmaker. Like when I remember when I watched Ryan Coogler's, I don't know if he made another film, but like this will make him put on the map. I feel like he will get more opportunities to make more movies and whatnot. I think he has like a great as a filmmaker. I think he's great. I just wish when it comes to especially the second half of the movie, it gets kind of disoriented when it's like the cutting between all these characters you have to care about. I feel like they either had to throw those out or we just have to pay attention to O'Neill and Hampton. Like I understand why they needed those characters, but at the same time, like I don't know if it helped the film to have all like the deaths in the in between. Like we know, yeah, it's kind of odd to me. But do you have anything else to add to this? Anyone, Monique?
Well, I think one thing that I was thinking about is, let's see, did I lose my train of thought? There was.
I tend to do that with people.
No. It's not your fault. I was just oh gosh. Come back to me. I have something I was going to say, but I need to remember what
okay,
it was.
It's fine. How about you, Joel? You have anything to expand on any of that?
I will say. Because I don't know which one was created. I don't know what story was created for the film and what wasn't. The scene with the kid who a kid his friend was shot and then they brought him to another hospital and he died and then went on like his like rampage there. I was like, I kind of was leaving a weird taste in my mouth since I saw it like last night. That I was like, did this need to be there? I did like the scene with his mother. And how they're gonna name this hospital after him, but that like talking about could this be a miniseries? I'm like, well, that could the incident before that, the incident that kind of sparks all that. I'm like, yeah, I don't think I want to see a 30 minutes to an hour show with him. But I will say this: this is one of those films where I feel like in 5-10 years that we're gonna have it's gonna have like you look back and go, I can't believe this movie had this actor or that actor, or I saw this actor somewhere that that I hope everybody from this film goes on to be in larger projects. It's a Warner Brothers film, so it's already big, but I hope they all go off and do things, or this is some films I like to call like a character actor's paradise, where you go, I saw that guy from this way, and you go down a rabbit hole on Wikipedia or Internet Movie Database, and you're like, they all started at this film, so I hope this is a thing. And I hate to be like, well, I hope they all go off and do Marvel movies, because that's like the big thing that gets butts in the seats, and not just be someone's sassy friend on a CBS sitcom. But I was pleasantly surprised with seeing a predominantly black cast, all with actors that don't come from, this is no shade, but this is just going to give you an example of what I'm talking about, the like Tyler Perry school of acting that that everyone brought like a game and performances that I was like, well, I think all of you guys are probably going to do really well, and some of you might fall into that trap of being the black friend in a rom-com, but work is work. So I'm always happy, and I've just found a new generation of black actors to root for. So I can't be mad about that.
I agree with that. Like, I do hope everyone from the movie just becomes like the biggest names in Hollywood, because they were really fantastic in the movie and they helped ground the film for me. Like, they made it seem, of course, most of this happened in real life, but like they made the movie seem a lot more just realistic, and like I know who these people are in a sense, and like they really got what I feel like the movie wanted to be. And I almost wish that they had more to do in the movie, because they were really magnetic to me, and they helped make the movie better overall. And so I hope that they go on to bigger and better things. Like, I know, like, there is like Algie Smith is in it, Ashton Sanders, who's already had
Moonlight
a big career yeah. already, but it's like he's still trying to break out and like get into the big thing that will make him a big name, including Algie Smith. And I can't remember what the actress's name is, who was one of the main Black Panthers in the movie, but when I was watching her, she was just like I could see her playing like Cicely Tyson in the Cicely Tyson story if they ever make a biopic about her, because she was just so like raw and like in the character. Like I could see her doing a ton of different things, and so I hope that they all get the shine that they deserve. And I think I did remember what I was going to say about the movie, which maybe this is what it struggled with, is this idea of the unreliable narrator. I think it was something that you said, Benjamin, it was something about, or Joel, one of you guys said something about, I guess, the narrator, something to that effect, and it made me think of the fact that this movie struggles with the idea of who is the narrator that we're following, and I think it's trying to have both this idea of like, here is the true narrator, which is Fred Hampton, but yet here's the unreliable narrator. And I think if it was a different film, we would just see the story from the unreliable narrator's perspective. And I think maybe one reason why the film seems to struggle or like toggle between two different modes of telling a story is that maybe it doesn't trust its audience enough to rely on them to realize that we are following the unreliable narrator. And so that's why we keep getting scenes with Fred Hampton being, you know, larger than life as he was in real life, but just as a way of like showing the audience, this is who you need to be rooting for, this is who you need to be following. And with Lakeith Stanfield, with William O'Neill, we have his story, and even though we know he's in the wrong, maybe the film doesn't trust us to realize that he's wrong and that we should, I guess, that we should analyze his character from a more critical lens. And maybe that's my explanation about maybe where the movie kind of like gets confusing for me, because I already know that William O'Neill is the unreliable narrator, but it seems like the film is scared to let the audience realize that without holding its hand, if that makes sense.
That absolutely makes sense, because there's this, like the very ending, Joel mentioned this, where you do see real footage of O'Neill, and he asks that question, like, what do you tell your son about yourself when it comes to the Black Panther Party? So to that extent, I forgot the exact words. And then he sees himself as someone who did something good. Like and it's unfortunate because, you know, he committed suicide later that day, but even himself, like he saw himself as someone who was supporting the Black Panthers and whatnot. And I think that message is getting, it's not clear to audience, like how this character playing, you know, if you like Joel was mentioned, like he's the Judas of the film. And I think like there is this like, you know, struggle between these two characters that the audience doesn't know who to rely on, I guess you could say, like you were mentioning. And it is kind of confusing, if you're going in this cold not knowing anything about the Black Panthers, especially like Fred Hampton, I don't know if you I feel like it will be good because you'll want to know more about them, but it'll also be confusing about O'Neill's part in this whole thing, because they kind of, I don't think they go 100% sympathetic with the character, with him, especially in the end, but you do want to, you want to understand like the struggle, like the psychological struggle he was faced with this, especially like, that's what I'm thinking, like especially he was faced with this when he was young, like knowing that it was a teenager that had to pull this, and knowing, like, I'm thinking about the Exonerated Five, the Ava DuVernay film, where, like, they were manipulating the teenagers about the Central Park rape in there, and then how they were just taking advantage, like the law enforcement were taking advantage of them. It, like, that's the thing that came to mind, where you took advantage of this 17-year-old and made him go against his own, probably his own, you know, beliefs and whatnot, because you were keep on threatening him, you know, going to jail and whatnot. And it's just so, like, I felt bad at that time where about that character, but at the same time, you, what he did was also horrible too. It's like you say, like, it's hard to understand who to rely on sometimes, which narrator. Yeah.
And I think just for me, I think that's one thing that kind of makes me frustrated with some of the movies that come out now about civil rights. And maybe it was like this when I was growing up, I don't know, because I was a kid, but at least now when I'm critiquing movies, I think one thing that kind of irks me is the idea that some movies have that things were binary, like that there was a clear, I mean, of course there was, of course, you know, state sanctioned violence and the government trying to kill leaders of oppressed people, that's clearly wrong. But like within the groups themselves, like within like the Black Panther Party or within the civil rights leaders, there was a myriad of ideas about what they should do and what was the right way to go forward. Like even in, like I go a little bit into this with my book where I talk about how there were opposing sides within the civil rights movement, like they didn't want to have Claudette Colvin be the person, the icon for integrating buses, because she was a teenage unwed mother and they thought that she wouldn't be given as much sympathy. And so Rosa Parks took that iconic position as that, and basically it was, and this is not saying Rosa Parks did this, but the leadership was basically being like, let's X out Claudette, even though she was sitting on the bus first, let's use this other incident of Rosa Parks sitting on the bus as our moment to move forward. And that's complex in and of itself to do that, and to believe that one, that this girl wouldn't be believed over another person. And there just aren't a lot of movies about that kind of complexity within these social movements. And I think that's one thing that kind of frustrates me, is because a lot of these movies are about the surface level. And of course, it makes sense because it's trying to also educate while it's entertaining. But I just hope that at some point in the future, we get to a point where storytellers feel like they can tell these more complex stories without feeling like they'll be leading the audience astray, and without feeling like they have to constantly educate the audience on who these people are and what is right and wrong.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. Joel, do you have anything to add?
All right, and I could be wrong here, and I haven't done enough, but and I kind of hate, in a movie about Black folks, I'm gonna issue on like the one white guy. I don't want to see Jesse Plemons as a bad guy for a while. I think I've done enough. Like I think he's a good actor, and I don't want him to be typecast, because when he walked on, I'm like, great, you're gonna be that dude. And then I thought, you know, at least he's getting work. Like, I know if there's going to be a Black movie, he's going to be the bad guy. And I was like, I'm like, nah, I just want, if I was a director, I'm like, I'm going to cast this dude as a supportive white friend just to make Black America flip out for a hot second. But I say that to say this, that scene when he's with Nixon, and Nixon's like, what if you're
Hoover?
Hoover, yeah, sorry. That makeup wasn't good.
Oh yeah, that was terrible.
That when he's with Hoover, and Hoover brings up the question, what if your daughter brings home like a Negro? And I was like, it's too late in the game to give him some sort of social conscious, or like, I liked at the beginning, if they were gonna, like, I mean, there seemed like there were scenes at the beginning where he was like, you know, the KKK and the Black Panthers are one and the same, that I'm for, like, he'd worked on the Freedom Riders case, that I was like, maybe there's some sort of conflict there. I was just like, it kind of came up at the end there, and I was just like, I'm gonna take this with what this is, but I don't want to see Jesse Plemons do this character for a while. I think that, like, he's done this enough that this character needs to kind of go back and be better developed for the next whatever Black, God, I don't want to say civil rights movie, because while I enjoy these movies, I'm also like, can we just get like a, he's like, can we just get like a normal everyday, like, I'm gonna do this and it's not the best example, I want like a Before Sunrise with Black folks. And I know people don't like those movies because they just kind of like talk, but I don't want to see like pain and struggle all the time. I just like the, I sometimes I just like, I'd like to see everyday people doing with everyday drama stuff. That can we kind of retool this actor or this character and kind of go back and do that again? It's a whole other thing, but I that was like my, one of my last things about this movie was like, this character needs work, this actor doesn't need to do this anymore. Don't know when the next time this is going to come up, but I'm very like, my, I'm once I notice it like a film or two ago, that I'm like, yeah, this is something I'm starting to see in other films. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
I don't know if this is related, but if you want a palate cleanser, sorry, for Jesse Plemons, I would highly recommend Game Night. I don't know if you guys have watched it. Yes. His character's kind of quirky in it, but he's kind of steals the show in some scenes. It's a comedy, so I would recommend that. You mentioned about Before Sunset, before the show, Monique and I were talking about Barry Jenkins, and he has actually a film called Melancholy for Medicine. I think that's the name. Did you hear about this? I think, what are you going to say?
All right, so, man, before I go in, how does everyone feel about the film? Because I got like a hot 30 seconds.
Was it called Melancholy for Medicine or...
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Have you watched it? You haven't watched.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So you can go in as far as you want.
Okay, Joel, really quick for me is that I liked the film at the time. I haven't watched it since it came out. And I just remember because people were comparing it to Before Sunset. And then I think because I'm close to San Francisco. So like, and it takes place in San Francisco. I was like, oh, yeah, that's a cool landmark. And all I remember was that they were just walking around, and like, it's exactly like Before Sunset, but like, I think I liked it, but I don't remember things about it. So you could go off.
All right. That movie's really frustrating because I'm as a comedy writer and someone who's trying to do like a rom-com, people keep throwing that movie my way because I also like the Four trilogy, and I saw it and it's got like, I like, you know, I'm a Wyatt Cenac fan, and I thought the actress, I'm terrible with names, as anyone who started this podcast will know, I thought the leads were great, and I thought Barry Jenkins, it made me a fan. I've gone out of my way to see all his stuff, or I'm working on my way to seeing all his stuff. Like, I'm a fan for life. I say that to say this, there's like a 10-15 minute like scene where they go to a bookstore and it turns into a debate about gentrification.
Yes, I do remember this.
And I was livid. I was just like, how long does this go? I live it like, I have, my dad used to live in the Bay Area, I have friends there now, like I was in LA for a really long time. So if you're in LA, people in San Francisco who live in San Francisco or live in San Francisco feel it's necessary to tell you how great San Francisco is. Like, there's a weird beef between the cities sometimes. And then I'm like, okay, cool. San Francisco is a great expensive city. All right. And I was really invested in those two leads and that story and what was going to happen and all their little discussions. And Wyatt Cenapit just basically said that like 2-3 scenes before this happens. But then it's a literal debate that I'm talking heads to the camera, like Wyatt Cenapit and the lead actress disappear from the film, that I was just like, what the fuck, man? You ruined this movie. I'm so angry at you for making me sit through this. And I'm like, if it had been 5 minutes, it would have been fine. But 10 to 15, I was so angry that I was like, you have this talent. You've made a film in black and white. It's literally two people talking and walking around San Francisco. It's everything that I was like, all right, cool, fine. I like it on one point. It's San Francisco, so whatever with my LA beef. But this freaking debate was so, oh my God, I'm so angry about it, because it is literally just the movie dead stops. And then when they come back to them, I don't care. I had to fight my way to get back to these two characters and what's going on. And I'm like, this could have been a DVD extra, my guy. That I said, I am a fan of Barry Jenkins. I will gladly go see anything he does. I saw Moonlight in an empty theater on a Tuesday afternoon at 4:30. I know that because I took a picture, because I was like, I'm the only person in this theater. How is this happening at an AMC in Virginia? So I'm like, I support, but as you can tell, I'm really angry.
Sorry to disappoint you, Joel, but my partner and I, when we met, her and I only talked about gentrification in our first date. No, I'm just kidding. That is actually kind of awkward. Yeah, I understand. I need to revisit that movie now, because it is incredible how Barry Jenkins came from that movie, and then, like, I think 5 years later, he made Moonlight. And those are, like, he never had a film in between. And I always felt that that was incredible.
He's a commercial director. Yeah, and yeah, I think he's on demand as a commercial director. That, because I think somebody brought up that, like, Moonlight was made the least amount of money compared to all the other Oscar winners. And that came out that he directs commercials. And I went, yeah, I completely get that now, that you dipped into this because this was a passion project. And you can feel, at least I felt, you could feel the love in the film, but it didn't feel like it was a guy who had to make a film. Like mm-hmm. he needed to make a film to get his next pay, like to eat.
Well, I have a question regarding that movie for Joel. Do you think that he might have, like, put that whole gentrification thing in there because of, like, there's kind of like a pressure for Black artists Black directors to, like, always put some kind of Black political element in their movies? Like, it seems like it kind of just goes hand in hand with, like, if you're making a Black movie, or not a Black movie, but a movie with Black characters in it, that it's almost expected of you to have, like, we need to talk about gentrification, we need to talk about redlining, we need to talk about, you know, these things. So, like, do you think that that was put in there because of, like, an expectation or what?
See, if Wyatt Cenac had not taught, his character had not talked about that, because he goes into, like, a monologue about how his parents met and how they lived, like, basically they had all lived in, like, one neighborhood or, like, two neighborhoods, and how gentrification had destroyed that, and it hadn't been 2-3 scenes before that, then I'd be like, yeah, this feels like some sort of pressure to put that in. This feels like someone giving you a footnote to what Synapse character had said. And I'm like, This doesn't need to be there. That the character in his monologue about his parents or his childhood expresses everything that this debate or cut talking head segment does. And that is one of the reasons why I'm so frustrated by it. That I'm like, you're just beating this head nail over this head. And I think other filmmakers, Black filmmakers, do feel like it's necessary to have moments in there like that. And right now I can't think of any, but I see where, like, that question is very valid. I just think with this film, where you have an actual character give not only debt, like, he brings up this issue that's happening in Black communities and Black and Latino communities, and Asian, I would assume. I only say that because I've only lived, when I'm in California, I only lived in Black, predominantly Black and Hispanic neighborhoods where this is happening. That it not only gave you, like, we're going to talk about the social issue, but we're also going to give you character depth, and you understand where the Wyatt Cenap character is, Cenap character is coming from. That it gives an extra layer to his character, in the sense that the woman he's having a one night stand with, she's Black but dating a white guy, and how he views that and that views her, that it doesn't just come off of him being, it's racist, like, you're being an asshole, but this asshole has, we understand why he's a dick. I can't condone it, but I'm like, at least I know where you're coming from. That I got all that, but then that talking head segment was just, like I said, hitting the hammer on the nail. Yeah.
I'm actually researching, because I was always curious of, like, how much that film, like, budget wise, because I think Wyatt Cenap at the time was just in the cusp of, like, being in the Daily Show. I don't think he was in the Daily Show at the time. It was only $15,000. Like, I was, I'm kind of surprised that how much it was made for. I mean, it's just people talking, but yeah.
Yeah, as someone who wanted to be a director, I'm like, yeah, you can see that it was inexpensive, but the writing was so solid and the acting was so there that I looked past that. I was like, this looks like this could have been done, and not a knock to anyone, but you could have done this on an iPhone. There isn't a lot of shots in there that I was like, well, you need a 3 setup here or how many days here. This looks like you could have just gotten, like, an old DV camera or done it very, very on the cheap and still made this quality. I think that's what attracted me initially to wanting to be a fan of Jenkins.
Cool. Yeah, I've been a fan since, so. But yeah, I think we got all deviated from the main discussion, but that is, Joel is talking about Medicine for Melancholy. That's the correct title. I think I kept on confusing the reversing it. I don't think you could watch it anywhere, but, if you can, I say watch it, but you don't have to. It's not like something that you need to watch it. But, that is our discussion overall of Judas and the Black Messiah. That is on HBO Max. I think all of us thinks it was good. And I think, we just watch it if you want to. But if anything, when you come out of it, I say do more research about Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers part. I think you get more out of it from that. But before we leave, I want to ask Monique first, because we do this thing called the Freaking Awesome List. And there's about 5 items on the list. And every guest that comes in, we've been asking them. It could be anything this past year or within the things that you've done that you think is, like, freaking awesome. And if you want to recommend it to our listeners, do you have... This is actually, before I ask you, but this is what's on the list right now, is Netflix's Queen's Gambit. There's an album from Hawaii called Kawi that is recommended by Chachi. This is my brother's, who's usually co-host with me. His thing is Bernie Sanders Mittens. Joel, the previous episode mentioned the graphic novel Smooth City, which I actually purchased and I'm about to read it. But how about you? Do you have anything to recommend in this list?
Let's see. A lot of the things I had written down were things that will probably be happening later in the year. So yeah. I don't know if it's like, I guess I could still recommend it.
Yes.
The one thing that I know is happening in 2021 is the Sandman TV series.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I've been a fan of Neil Gaiman's Sandman comics. They really resonated with me when I started reading them. Like, I know I was late to the game reading them in college, but I started reading them in college, and they really, like, expanded what comic books could be. And this was after I had read Watchmen several years before, and I was already like, wow, graphic novels. And the Sandman was like, wow, so it can, you can, like, expand the idea of the graphic novel even more than what Watchmen has done. And for that, for its creativity and its innovation, like, I really love these experimental stories. And so it'll be really interesting to see when the TV show comes out. And I hope it keeps that same experimental spirit, that same kind of, like, mystical, I don't know what is going on, but I want to see what's happening spirit. So yeah, that's the one thing. I had some other things written down, but I don't know if they're happening. I don't know if they are happening in 2021, but the Sandman is definitely something I'm looking forward to.
So you recommend the graphic novel and the upcoming television show. That's
right.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I have not read the graphic novel. I know I've been it's on my list of things to watch. I just don't have time at this moment, but I am looking forward for all of that. I'm assuming, Joel, you read Sandman?
No.
Okay.
I
don't know.
I had a roommate who is a big Neil Gaiman fan. We went and saw him do a live reading. Man has a voice of a god.
Yes.
but I couldn't get into Sandman. I gave it a shot, and I it wasn't my thing, but I could listen to that man read the phone book.
But I'm going to put it on the list, and that is now going to be on the list. Thank you, Monique. Before we leave, I want to ask you, where can they find you online, Monique?
You can find me on Twitter under my main Twitter handle, MoniqueBlognet. You can also check out my website's Twitter handle, which is ColorWebMag. And you can also look at ColorWebMag on Facebook and Instagram. I, of course, have my website, which the official name is just AdColor, but it's colorwebmag.com. I have the Book of Awesome Black Americans, which has been top rated on Amazon several times now, which is great. That was published last January, so this is basically its like 1 year anniversary this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thanks. And so, you know, pick that up, leave a comment, a review on Amazon, because they help keep the book in Amazon's algorithm and keeps it being recommended to potential readers. And let's see, I also have my portfolio site, which is MoniqueJonesOnline.com, and you can see all the various things that I've done, from my website to working with Magic the Gathering, creating Kaya, the first planeswalker, first African-American female planeswalker for the company, and some other stuff that I'm sure I'm forgetting. So there you go.
Well, thank you. How about you, Joel?
You can find me at milliondollarunderwearzine.com and on Twitter at Barber Comedy. Yeah.
Like, once again, like, to the listeners, I'm huge fans of both of them. And there's a reason why I always ask you guys to come on the podcast. And I'm always thankful that you guys are always say yes. But I'm fans of also your work outside of the podcast, of course, like your books and whatnot. And but yeah, I'm always recommending to listeners to please support read their stuff too. For me, you can find me on Benjamin Abaya on Twitter and Instagram. You can find this podcast on Twitter and Instagram at TFA Now, or you could like us on Facebook on The Freaking Awesome, or join the Discord server, which we'll link on our show notes. Please subscribe, rate, and leave comments on iTunes and Google Play at thefreakingawesome.com. Remember, there is another podcast called The Freaking Awesome podcast, but we are the one that has like that pinkish logo, and I think we use an exclamation point at the end of that. You could, you know, I don't know. I never listened to other podcasts. I don't even want to talk about them because I don't want to. I don't want to boost their their listenership too. But yeah, email us if you have any concerns, comments, or corrections at contacts@thefreakingawesome.com. I keep on mentioning this in throughout every episodes, but my brother and I decided to create a Patreon, and I think we're going to bring it out in the 1st of March. Hopefully you guys see that. We're going to talk more about it as it as we develop it more. But yeah, you could please support us all, and thank you for listening. I'm Benjamin Abaya.
I'm Monique Jones.
I'm Joel Barber.
And this has been the Freaking Awesome Podcast.